This is Alimbayev v. Attorney General. Mr. Rudnick. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Lawrence Rudnick. I represent the petitioner Alimbayev, and I ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal time. This is the second time this case has been before the Court. The first time it was remanded on motion of the government, and the government's motion for remand back to the Board of Immigration Appeals tracked carefully the arguments made by the petitioner regarding the second board decision, in which the board tramples on the fact-finding made by the immigration court. On remand, instead of addressing the specific issues, the board simply invokes by language the clearly erroneous rule to overturn the fact findings that it disregarded in the first two board decisions. And they do precisely what Judge Jordan said they should not do in the Huang case, which is pick and choose parts of the record and have that be a basis to reverse the IJ's credibility findings.
Maybe that may be true, but before we get to that, I want to ask you about our standard of review as well. What is it that we have to do as we're looking at what the BIA did here in reviewing the IJ's decision? What are we bound to do? What lens are we supposed to put on this?
Well, there are three categories of relief, and there are different levels of review. For the adjustment of status application, we call it application for adjustment of status to permanent residence, the green card application based on marriage to the U.S. citizen, the ultimate discretionary decision of the BIA is insulated from review.
Right. We can't look at it at all, right?
You can't. The ultimate judgment. Under this court in Parija, which was not an adjustment status case, but it was a cancellation of removal case like the one earlier today, says that this court has authority to review issues of law and flawed fact-finding. And that's exactly what we have here. Issues of law, number one, the misapplication of the clearly erroneous rule. I mean, the clearly erroneous rule, if it means anything, it does mean that the immigration judge who wrote a thorough 37-page decision can't have it nitpicked on two or three facts that the board disagrees with.
But what the board could do, could it not, is to say, look, you're entitled to make those findings a fact. We're entitled to make an unreviewable decision in our discretion, delegated to us from the Attorney General, to say, you may think what you think, and I have to accept that if it's not clear or erroneous, but in weighing it all ourselves, we just still don't like the risk. So he loses on adjustment of status. If they had proceeded in that way, hypothetically, and it just accepted the fact-finding of the IJ but said, we still don't like the way this looks, we're not comfortable with the risk, that would be something we couldn't look at. Is that right?
Well, you could still look at subsidiary legal conclusions and findings of fact. And again, this would be, if the board hadn't invoked the clearly erroneous rule, we'd be where Huang was or Kaplan was, which is the board trampled the clearly erroneous rule explicitly.
Well,
whereas here,
I'm asking you to engage with this hypothetical. Assume that the board said, We're not going to quote nitpick. We're accepting your findings of fact because we're not going to say they're clearly erroneous. And yet, when we look at the things that are out there, we're still uncomfortable with adjusting the status for this individual. We think there's still too much of a risk, even if we disbelieve Ms. Chapman and we do believe his present wife. And given all that, we still don't like it. That's a discretionary decision that we couldn't review. Is that right?
Correct. How to actually weigh the facts properly found is for the board.
What is the remedy you're asking? Because doesn't this go to whether, even if we were to find legal error, in the rejection of the credibility findings and application of the clear error standard, wouldn't that simply mean we'd be remanding for reweighing on adjustment of status or for the BIA to address, with those credibility findings, whether your client has met his burden as to the other relief that he seeks?
We're asking for the BIA to be required to decide the case on the facts found by the IJ, because the facts found by the IJ in its decision, and hypothetically they could have written a different decision, but they didn't. They wrote a decision that said, we believe Ms. Chapman, we don't believe the petitioner, and that is just tramples on the clearly erroneous rule. The judge heard the testimony. He was the trial judge. He saw the witnesses. I mean, if there's ever a case where the clearly erroneous rule would apply, this would not be it. He had a choice. I believe A or I believe B. He believed A. He believed the petitioner. He didn't believe the witness. It seems to me that that's not the kind of perceived error that a court of appeals would apply to a district court decision or that the board should apply. And the standard of review on this, as articulated in the Lynn case from the Second Circuit, is that this court has de novo authority to decide whether the board properly applied the clearly erroneous rule.
But you're not arguing as to any of the grounds for relief, any of the claims that you're not asking this court to rule as a matter of law on the relief as in Yusupov.
We cannot ask this court for the same relief as in Yusupov because of the statutory bar. That was taken out by the 1996 amendments, unfortunately. But the court can make the agency decide the case on the correct facts and apply the correct law. There's a number of legal errors and I also want to talk about the withholding claim.
Before you do that, I think Judge Stern's got a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Actually, trying to follow up on Judge Jordan's question. If the BIA had accepted all of the fact findings of the IJ, but then simply said, you weighed them incorrectly, you gave too much weight to credibility and not enough weight to evidence about video tapes, would that be insulated from any review, even if we thought that they had gotten the formula misbalanced?
There may be some point at which the decision is so irrational as to require review. The court certainly has authority to require an agency to articulate its reasons. But you
haven't made a constitutional argument.
No.
There's no argument here that this was so far gone it was unconstitutional. You've made a pure, straight-up legal challenge to the application
Correct. That
the BIA made of the standard of review with respect to clear error, right?
Correct.
So the answer to Judge Stern's question, as it was to mine, is, yeah, they could do that, and that's insulated from review, right?
Largely, if not completely, yes.
And they may well do that on remand.
They could.
If we were to agree with your position.
They could. I would hope that the board, if properly instructed, as I believe the court would instruct them, would be to decide the case on the facts found by the immigration court. And that would greatly alter the assessment of hardships. I mean, if you don't credit Chapman's testimony, you don't have the bad character issue. You have other legal issues. The board diminishes the status of an immediate relative. The Congress has given the status of immediate relatives, people married to U.S. citizens, a high status, even recognized by the agency. And it's disdained by the BIA in this case, by the BIA simply saying, well, they got married while they were in removal proceedings.
Before we address particular pieces of evidence, just to go back to the scope of the issues and you're raising on appeal, the fact-finding that you are taking issue with relates simply to credibility. The credibility finding, is that right?
And corroboration. Looking at the way the statute reads and the Department of Justice regulation, the statute says the trier of fact, and this is Section 208 of the Immigration Act, 1158 of the U.S. Code, the statute says the trier of fact determines the facts and considers and tells them what to consider and says the trier of fact also determines the need for corroboration. The immigration judge was satisfied with the corroboration, in particular
because... Does that mean that the BIA can't, is foreclosed from saying, when we look at it, you might have thought you didn't need corroboration, but this is something that we would have thought there would be corroboration on and we're troubled by.
I think if they do that, it has to go back to the IJ.
Yeah.
Because the statute says the IJ is the trier of fact. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But they could say that, right?
They could.
Now, there is an issue here. You point out that the IJ, you know, gave a thorough and a detailed decision, et cetera. But was there a problem with the IJ saying, you know what, in effect, I don't like what the BIA did the first time, so I'm reopening.
Well,
I'm dealing with this adjustment of status issue again. How can a system function in a hierarchical decision-making organization if the court of first instance, as you've analogized the IJ to, is free to say, you know, I really don't like what the appellate tribunal did, so I'm doing this over myself?
Well, they have a very idiosyncratic rule, maybe not one that you or I would pick, but in matter of Patel, as affirmed in this court's decision in Johnson, says that unless the board retains jurisdiction over the case and remands for a limited purpose, the IJ is free on remand to consider any issues. And
even though the BIA has covered the territory, rendered a decision, spoken specifically to it, the IJ is free to say, yeah, I don't like what you did.
Correct.
I'm doing it again.
Yeah, correct. And I don't think the government even defends the BIA's position on this. The way I read the government's brief is they're claiming harmless error. They're saying, well, they reached the merits, so you don't have to worry about that issue. But they're clearly wrong. The matter of Patel is a binding precedent decision, a binding Third Circuit precedent that says that on remand in the Third Circuit case in Johnson, the judge had denied the asylum application the first time. It went back on the what we call a CAT claim, the Convention Against Torture claim, and then the IJ said, you know what, I'm going to reconsider the asylum claim and granted the second asylum application. It's exactly this case. It couldn't be more on point. So while there may be other rules that foster more efficiency, that's not the rule this agency uses.
As to the asylum claim, the BIA noted the one-year time bar. What is it about about any credibility finding that would give any ground for us to revisit the BIA's conclusion as to the time bar on asylum?
With regard to the time bar, it's not reviewable. We can't argue this asylum case except insofar as the board adopted its asylum fact-finding to deny the other two remedies, which are not time-barred, the withholding of removal because the IJ determined that this individual would be subject to his life or freedom, would be under threat in Uzbekistan, and for very good reasons, and also decided that predicting the future facts, that when he went back, he'd be identified as a Muslim of the type that's considered to be subject to persecution.
Well, wait a second. That looks like maybe the rabbit goes in the hat right there. Is it the case that deciding whether there's going to be persecution is a question of fact or law? The fact finding about, you know, you might be identified, or you walk in and find you're having trouble, That may stand, but whether that reaches, well, I got two questions for you. First, whether the facts put forward are sufficient to meet the preponderance of evidence standard that both the withholding of removal and the CAT claim require, that's a legal question, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay.
But the legal
question. So the board could accept the fact finding of the IJ on those and say, but it doesn't rise to the level of a preponderance in our view. And that would not be something that is fact-bound, but is a legal point.
Right, that would be an error of law. And I'm much more comfortable with that scenario because this court has jurisdiction as it did in Yusupov. I mean, the board could do what they did in Yusupov and say, yeah, okay, the facts are the facts. We still find a ground of preclusion, and this court can then rule as a matter of law that's not correct. This court has the authority on the withholding and the Convention Against Torture claims to decide legal error.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate judgment is before the court.
And the second question is whether or not the facts found are sufficient, maybe this is saying the same thing twice, are really sufficient to say that means persecution is likely to happen Again, that's the legal point that the BIA is entitled to reach a decision on.
The BIA has plenary authority, but not absolute discretion.
Right.
It's the distinction. They have plenary authority to decide whether the facts found by the IJ objectively amount to a reasonable grounds of persecution, whether they amount to a preponderance of the evidence that the individual's life or freedom will be threatened, or whether the individual will be subject to torture under the Convention Against Torture.
You agree that asylum is off the table at this point?
Yeah, it is. This Court's made clear in several precedent decisions.
Earlier in your argument, the issue of Chapman, the ex-wife's testimony, you referenced in your brief that there was clear error in the IJ's findings by the BIA, as you call it, reweighing the ex-wife's testimony. Is it your position that the IJ didn't make a credibility finding, so that what the BIA was doing was, in fact, reweighing, or that there's an implicit credibility finding that should be reviewed for clear error?
Certainly the latter. It's an implicit credibility finding. And then the judge makes that clear later on. It is somewhat ambiguous in the beginning of his opinion, and he sort of doesn't want to call her a liar. But later on he says, look, I've got a choice. I either believe Allenbev or I believe Chapman, and I believe Allenbev. So that's, I think, more than an implicit, I think it's almost explicit fact-finding.
What do we do with the fact that those issues as to the fact-finding and the credibility determinations were specifically part of the order on remand? The IJ knew as of the second hearing what the BIA's concern was. Nonetheless, the IJ, even in the second order, didn't make an explicit credibility finding, and the BIA, in its review, then is treating that as something it can address as an open question.
The board says it's clear error finding. The board treated it as a fact finding in its decision. The board says this finding with regard to the ex-wife's testimony, Chapman, is an error of law. An error of fact. It's a clear error. And they proceed to explain why they would have credited her testimony. It's very thin what the board says is why they would have credited the testimony. It's certainly not enough to make the fact finding of the person, the judge who heard the evidence. I mean, they basically claim that she should be believed rather than the applicant, because basically they preferred her testimony, which is not the clearly erroneous standard.
Okay. Thank you thanks very much, Mr. Rendick. Mr. Smula, am I saying your name right, sir?
Judge?
You're up, and I'm afraid I just murdered your name. How do you say it, sir?
You actually got it correct, which is the rare circumstance, thank you for that, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. It is Daniel Smula on behalf of the United States Attorney General.
All right.
Your Honors, there is no issue before the Court that's susceptible to review. The Court lacks jurisdiction to review the discretionary denial of cancellation of removal. And to be clear, there's no dispute that Mr. Allenbev is statutorily eligible. This rests entirely on a discretionary denial in the INA, and in this Court's case law is clear that there is no jurisdiction to review that matter.
Well, why aren't we free to review errors of law, even if we're not free to review the ultimate discretionary decision? In other words, speak directly to Mr. Rudnick's point, which is if the BIA ignores the standard of review, it is required by its own regulations to apply. That is something that we are entitled to step in and correct.
Had that occurred, there would be an error of law for this Court to review, but that did not occur in this case.
So they say it did occur.
Yes.
You say it didn't occur. But whether it occurred or not is a question of law, which we can review. We're not stripped of jurisdiction to answer the question whether or not the BIA ignored the clearly erroneous standard imposed on it by its own regulations, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. The court always has jurisdiction to ascertain whether it has jurisdiction.
Right.
But a limited review of simply does this rise to the level of a cognizable and colorable legal claim will reveal that such a claim does not exist in this case, and therefore there's a lack of jurisdiction.
Speak to Mr. Rudnick's point
and we've spent a lot of time looking at the record in this case, it sure looks like the BIA really did not like the IJ's fact-finding. But where is it clear error to say, I saw them both testify, I thought she was not believable, Ms. Chapman, and biased, and I thought Mr. Limbev, he was believable, and so I credit that. Why isn't that the classic he said, she said dispute as to which an appellate tribunal is always obligated to defer to the judge on the scene who saw and heard the testimony?
Because, Your Honor, the IJ, both in 2010 and 2014, in the 2010 decision I'll cite to is page 1132 of the record, in 2014 is page 229 of the record, made a limited credibility finding insofar as Chapman was credible, I'm going to give her testimony little weight for several reasons, including, well, they were divorced and the FBI paid her $1,000. That is very different from an adverse credibility finding, which was not made, again, twice. In this case, the IJ had it, and on two occasions, he afforded her testimony limited weight.
But ultimately, in the second hearing, in the 2014 hearing, petitioner testifies, and as I understand the record, contrary to the BIA's assertion, does offer direct rebuttal testimony as to whether he watched those videos that she testified he watched. And then the IJ concludes that it is crediting his testimony that he did not. How is that not a credibility finding?
Because the immigration judge, this was a matter of weight. Okay, and the weight assigned to the various witnesses' testimony at particular times.
Precisely. That's the very point, Mr. Smullo. It's the weight that the fact finder on the scene gives to the people appearing before him or her. And, yes. And here, looking at the two, he says, I think this one's more believable, so I credit that testimony. I think this one's less believable, so I don't credit that testimony. I've got diametrically opposed assertions. I have to pick one. I pick A, not B. How is it, quote, clear error for the IJ to do that and not just, you know, the BIA not liking it and saying, I wish you'd said B, which they're not free to do under the clear error standard.
Setting aside the clear error standard for a moment, if I could, had the IJ issued an adverse credibility finding as to Chapman, then yes, the board would have had to find clear error to reverse that. The IJ did not do so, and understanding, and this gets a little bit tricky in the board.
Hold on, let me make sure I understand. Are you saying that there were special words that the IJ had to say? The IJ had to say, I'm making an adverse credibility finding here, and I'm making a positive credibility finding here. It's not enough for the IJ to say, I heard this and believed it. I heard that and I didn't believe it.
Yes. I am saying that under the INA, it's unique. Congress has somewhat legislated credibility findings.
Where is that? Where is that in the law that the words adverse credibility finding or something akin to it have to be inserted in the IJ's decision making in order for the clearly erroneous standard to kick in?
I believe generally, Your Honor, it's 12. This is 8 United States Code Title 8, Section 1229A C4B, I believe. But C4 should certainly get, Your Honor, close to the credibility standard. With respect to asylum, it's 1158B1B2, where it's clear that it is, again, the petitioner's burden, okay, to prove eligibility for this discretionary relief or for asylum for whatever various applications for relief or protection from removal that a particular petitioner seeks. In Real ID, Congress legislated credibility findings and said, yes, essentially, there must be a credibility finding.
Sure.
If there is no credibility finding,
it looks like there was a credibility finding. You seem to be saying, well, there was, but there really wasn't, but there was, but there wasn't.
Then I'm not being clear, and I apologize. So there's, as to Chapman, the IJ afforded her testimony limited weight. The board is within its rights to say, the board assigns more weight than did an IJ. This is not an instance of fact finding because Chapman's testimony is what it is.
Their testimony is joined. It is directly on point on the specific issue of whether or not he watched videos that she alleged he watched during the course of their marriage. and he offered rebuttal testimony that the IJ credited. How is that, and you could call it not giving weight to her testimony, but where what's at issue is directly contradictory testimony on exactly the same very narrow point. How is that not a credibility finding?
It's not. It comes back, truly under the immigration law, which is a unique subset, it comes back to the fact that the IJ did not say, I find that Chapman lacks credibility as to this.
This is a new law to me, that it's not open to the IJ to believe a witness in some respects and not disbelieve in others. I believe Ms. Chapman was married to Petitioner. I just don't happen to believe her on this issue of what he was viewing. Congress can't have said that.
I think that's right. In the immigration judge's decision at this point is a little bit muddled, and bluntly, the board's decision is a little bit muddled as well, in terms of are they applying clear error or reweighing the evidence.
With all respect, I don't think the IJ's decision was muddled at all. They, as Judge Krause has pointed out, the issue was joined. It was a fact-finding, diametrically opposed points of view from the two witnesses, and a decision was made on who was more believable than the other. Now, what I'm having trouble getting my head around is, since it is an unfettered matter of discretion for the Attorney General, who has delegated this to the BIA, why didn't the BIA, if it wanted to say, we don't like the risk here, just say it? I mean, why do back somersaults to try to say, well, you know, we think this is clear error because you gave some weight, not enough weight, and you didn't use the magic words adverse credibility finding. I mean, if the point of the BIA's decision is we still don't like the risk, why doesn't the BIA, I mean, just come up and say straight up, we don't like the risk?
The BIA did that, and I think it was 2012 decision, and then, of course, this court remanded with instructions to address the credibility.
So theoretically, it could do it again, right?
I think that there have been now three BIA decisions. I think it's fairly clear that the board will not grant discretionary relief in this case. I can't obviously predict what it would do in the future, but three times it's denied as a matter of discretion. I think it's fair to say that a fourth were in front of the board a fourth time that it would again deny as a matter of discretion.
What about withholding of removal and Convention Against Torture Relief? There is a set of statements in the IJ's decision, and I want to quote this for you. This is in the record at 243. As noted above, respondent is at serious risk of being arbitrarily arrested under Uzbekistan's vague anti-extremism laws based on the perception that he is a dissident because of his association with Nazarov and his former roommates. If respondent is arrested, it is likely that he would be forced to confess, sentenced to a number of years in abject prison conditions. It is not reasonable to expect respondent to escape persecution by moving to another part of Uzbekistan since he fears persecution by the government. Okay. Those are the IJ's words.
Yes.
Are those findings of fact or conclusions of law?
Mostly they're findings of fact, Your Honor.
Okay. So if the IJ makes these predictions about what's likely to happen when and if Mr. Limbev is removed to Uzbekistan, isn't the board obligated to view those things again through the clearly erroneous standard?
Yes. Now if I could continue to answer the question, short answer is yes. The lengthier one is I'm going to set aside, if I could, the waiver of withholding and cat protection that the government believes occurred in this case. The court then did go on and establish and find clear error, and it properly did so. I know the petitioner referenced the Second Circuit opinion in Lynn, that appears at 813 of the Fed Third, where the Second Circuit says that review of the board's clear error finding is de novo, but it then goes on, and this is, I think, a very important point from the Second Circuit. It says, although we are reviewing the board's clear error determination de novo, we are not stepping in on behalf of the board or for the board.
That's recognizing what I think your learned colleague has been addressing to us, and I hear you not disagreeing with us on, and that, or him on, and that is whether or not the BIA applied clear error review is a question of law that we review. Right?
Yes.
Right.
And
here that's all the Second Circuit saying.
Yes.
We don't want to step in and do our own fact-finding.
Yes.
But we can look at the record and we can see whether what you did, no matter what you called it, you can call it whatever you want, BIA, but if what you were doing was something other than applying clear error review, we, the courts, have an opportunity and obligation to point that out. That's our job, right?
Yes, and taking Lynn, which clarified that a court, an appellate court, looks for two things. One is, did the board justify, is there sufficient justification for the board's clear error finding? And second is, of course, the prohibition on fact-finding.
So where is it in there, Mr. Cimullo, that the board in this case undermined or was able to demonstrate that those fact findings I quoted to you from the record are clearly erroneous? How did it point out that that was at odds with the record?
I don't quite recall every fact you gave me, so I think this should answer Your Honor's question. But the first was it's finding that Mr. Alambayev was not worthy of belief. Specifically, he... Yes, Judge?
Okay. That he wasn't worthy of belief. How can the board, who didn't see him, make the judgment that he wasn't worthy of belief when the IJ, who did see him, said he is worthy of belief, if all the board says is, we don't believe him?
This is more than just a demeanor finding, Your Honor. This is the board taking the evidence, Mr. Alambayev's testimony itself, and finding that the IJ erred clearly and erroneously by finding him credible. Specifically, his...
Don't they have to, in order to demonstrate clear error, don't they have to show that there are aspects of the record that undermine what
yes.
he said? There are things that you could look to in the record that would point out that what he said was just complete, was not believable.
Yes, and they did that, Your Honor. At pages 5-6 of the administrative record, they first cited his claim that, look, the Uzbek authorities, my dad told me the Uzbek authorities were interested in my Philadelphia roommates as of August 2001.
Right.
But Mr. Alambayev himself testified that he had not met them in August in 2001. He did not meet them all until October of 2001. So there is one example of clear error, sufficiently justified. And another is his implausible testimony regarding the circumstances of his entry into the United States, and also his submission of two applications to extend his non-immigrant visa. One pertained to his parents are wealthy, and he's a computer guy who came in. I mean, just nonsense that he acknowledged later was not true. The second application was from an institution called the Concord Language Institute. He later admitted, I have no idea, I don't recall applying to the school, and yet he submitted a form, or he had his friend submitting a form, that somehow justified his extension of non-immigrant status in the United States. A third instance at the board, if I could finish my sentence, please, Your Honors, I see my time is up. A third instance is that in his initial testimony, he testified that he attended Nazarov's mosque in Uzbekistan two or three times, and on remand, when it came back from the board, all of a sudden he tripled that number to 6-8 times. So there are three examples of his testimony that is wholly inconsistent and implausible. And I think a clear error in this court's opinion in Menendez, Anderson versus City of Bessemer, really drives home the point that implausible testimony is in fact clear error. In the board, I submit, Your Honors, found clear error properly here. If there's no jurisdiction to review the petition, if there are no further questions, I'll submit on my brief.
Just so I understand, so a four-month discrepancy about dates.
Yes.
And making yourself out to be slightly more religious than you portrayed yourself to be, these are wholly implausible.
They become wholly implausible when it is the fundamental reason that you purport to fear returning home. Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I didn't. The Uzbek authorities knew about my association with my Philadelphia roommates before I met them. It is wholly implausible. And again, under the Second Circuit's Lynn opinion, that the board sufficiently justified its decision in that case and did not find.
He gave an explanation that he was confused about the dates, and the IJ credited that explanation.
The IJ did, but the board did not have to, Your Honor.
If we could you sit down, return to the ex-wife's testimony, because the BIA takes issue specifically with the issue of whether or not she's biased, disagreeing with that. To the extent that we may view that as a revisiting a credibility finding, the two grounds that the BIA seems to give, I'd appreciate if you could address for disagreeing with the BIA's, with the IJ's determination. One is that the petitioner, it says, did not specifically rebut her testimony in either 2010 or on remand in 2014. Does the government agree in the 2014 hearing petitioner actually did rebut her testimony on the issue of watching the videotapes?
That's my recollection, Your Honor, that it did. Although, Your Honor, if I could, the bias also went, I think, to the notion that, well, this is an ex-wife, so she's biased against me. In his initial testimony, the divorce was amicable. And only again upon remand from the board, suddenly the divorce was not so amicable, but she was likely biased against me.
Well, at that point, he'd heard her testimony and perhaps had a different view of her approach. In any event, the IJ expressed his view. The second ground, though, given by the BIA for revisiting the ex-wife's testimony is a statement that evidence of record, including testimony from a government agent, corroborates her testimony and establishes that violent videos and other such materials were found on the computer that was recovered from the respondent's residence, close quote. I want to understand, does the government agree the agent's testimony as to videos related to the shared apartment on Allen Street?
Yes.
Years earlier.
Yes.
There was no agent testimony as to a computer from the marital residence.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's correct. That was never seized or reviewed.
Yes. Your reading is the correct reading, Your Honor. And I would note that although there is some error insofar as they conflated the two, at the end, the discretionary denial is going to go to what is apparently his proclivity to watching and celebrating terrorist videos. And to that end, it's really rather harmless error.
All right. Thank you so very much. Mr. Small.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rednick, have your rebuttal.
Quickly on the whether, I certainly agree that there's no magic words required. We look at the substance rather than the label. But the board clearly understood Chapman's testimony as an issue of fact. They say, thus, given the direct circumstantial evidence in the record as a whole, we find the immigration judge clearly erred in rejecting the respondent's ex-wife's testimony concerning the computer, use of the computer and his character. And then they chose to believe her because he had said the divorce was amicable, which is ridiculous because the judge had an opportunity to see that it was not an amicable divorce from her point of view. It may have been from his, but it certainly wasn't amicable from her point of view. She alleges abuse, and there's no corroboration of her testimony.
When you say there's none, it's not mentioned. I mean, I didn't see it in the government's briefing, but she says he made me watch these videos on a site called Ogrish.
Yeah.
And independent of that, forensics showed that videos were being watched on Ogrish. Now, unless you're positing that she was in touch with DHS agents and coordinated her testimony, that certainly sounds like some corroborating fact, doesn't it?
It corroborates the fact that there was something on there.
Was something on there, and that she knew where it was being viewed because she identified the website where the offending videos were that she said he made her watch.
He says in his testimony, which the judge credited, he wasn't sure where he saw these.
I'm just pointing out that when you say, quote, there's no corroboration, it looks like there's some corroboration.
I think there is some. It's insufficient corroboration to overcome the IJ's finding. I mean, there was a joint task force. The government had full ability to bring in an FBI agent to say, well, yeah, she came in 2005 and told us she was saying these terrible things. Now, why they wouldn't have gone out and gotten him, if they believe that for a second, is another issue. But to move back to the withholding and convention claims, very quickly, there are three reasons given by the board for reversing the overall credibility determination. The first is the August 8th, August 10th, 2001. He's testifying in 2010 and 2014, and he's very vague about the dates. He says approximately. He keeps using the word approximately. It's hardly a smoking gun. And the other two issues are really don't relate much to the second one isn't related at all to the asylum application. It's that his description of how he came to the U.S. And the second part of that argued by counsel today is fairly amazing because the board accedes to the IJ's fact-finding that he did not commit immigration fraud, but all the terrible things that he's supposed to have lied about, they didn't lie about them. He didn't actually know about them. That's finding a fact by the judge upheld by the BIA. So I can hardly be used against him.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rudnick, and thank you, Mr. Moore. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. We've got the matter under advisement. We'll stand in recess.